You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, April 29th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks, and this one's super casual because we're on vacation. By now, I've had a couple of days to unwind, spend time with the kids, desperately want to get back to work. And come with me back through time when we reminisce back to when I was a young lad playing minor league baseball. Not like, you know, not like feeders to the majors, like, but where you can barely fit the glove and you can, you know, if the kid connects to the ball, it's like almost a guaranteed home run on errors. When I played for Dudley Esso. That used to be Exxon. Did you know that, Matt? Nope. Matt's just looking at me like he doesn't even. For all Matt knows, like we could, it's all hovercrafts now to him. He's like,
I thought Dudley Esso was a defunct cartoon character.
Nope. Dudley Esso. Dudley was like, you knew the guy who ran the gas station, and he came out. Maybe he had one or two other guys working for him, but he would pump your gas. No self serve. Exxon was called Esso at the time. I played on that team. And as I mentioned to Meg Jacobs, author of Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s, I think that's why the lines resonated with me. Because I remember like Dudley just coming out and just looking completely flummoxed and feeling attached, protective of him.
You know where I first came across gas lines was on 9/11. I remember after school, my parents picked me up from football practice, and there were lines at the gas stations around town.
Wow, that is weird.
That's what I thought of when I was listening to you record this.
Well, was there a shortage in the Dakotas?
I think it was just panic buying. Like people thought, oh, well, there's something that happened, so we better buy gas.
There's a lot of preppers out there, aren't there? Right? I mean, that's what it was all about, right? I mean, there was guys who were coming up with their, like, their 2-ton diesel pickup trucks filling up like tank after tank after like, you know, plastic tanks of gas.
Yeah, I think a lot of that.
Yeah. How many weapons do you think were in line at the gas station? Do you think there was a single car that didn't have a weapon in them?
One or two.
Yeah, one or two. Well, in Worcester, no weapons. Just big hulking, like a Plymouth Fury, like a Plymouth wagon. I remember we had a big Plymouth green station wagon. And you'd sit in these buggy seats in the back. Look out the back. It's when you didn't know any better and you'd keep the window down and everybody would get carbon monoxide poisoning. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Friday. It's Casual Friday. Enjoy this interview that I did and we will be back live on Monday. Matt will have, for members, a deep archive sort of fun thing today, right? And Monday we'll be back live. Just remember, it's the last day for you to go get 30% off of Just Coffee, .coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. Use the coupon code MRSPRING16. It's like the last day that you'll have the opportunity to do it. MRSPRING16. Go get 30% off your coffee. Do yourself a favor. Save on coffee. Try a great coffee. Coffee, coffee, coffee. Coffee, coffee, coffee. I am so excited. I'm getting giddy because this is it. Well, I'm actually not on vacation. I'm going to go. We're pre-recording this before I go to Vegas for those live shows. But It feels like I'm going on vacation. So that's why I'm getting very excited. Folks, if you have the opportunity to become a member, join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com. All right, going to take a quick break and go to Meg Jacobs. I should tell you, the song you're about to hear is one of two songs that are referenced in Meg's books and we bring up. The first one you're going to hear, and you'll just hear a segment of Bobby So Fine Butler. That was literally his nickname, So Fine Butler. Cheaper Crude or No More Food, ladies and gentlemen. Just to give you a sense of the insanity at that time. This was a hit in 1979. We're going to play a little segment of it, and then we'll put it at the end of the free show so you can hear the whole thing if you want. And at the end of the show, we're going to play Focal. It's a band called The Focal Minority. Freeze a Yankee. And this is from 1978. And we get to the meanings of these songs at the end of the interview because this basically covers the 70s. It goes a little further here, Brooke, but you'll understand. And these songs are going to blow you away because they are, you see, you know, the Donald Trumpisms and the Ted Cruz and all that sort of nasty right wing. It's always been there, folks. But this is where it became like a badge of honor. Although I guess maybe when they would give medals to Confederate soldiers, it was also a badge of honor. All right. So here is that interview I recorded with Meg Jacobs, Panic at the Pump, the Energy Crisis, and the Transformation of American Politics in 1970.
About a week, they'll sing a different tune. Crude oil prices have got so high, it's getting hard to survive. And I'll bet those Middle East countries are having a laugh. 'Cause the way things are going, well, it won't be very long till we're shelling out a buck and a half for a gallon of gas. If they don't lower the gas, we're gonna lower the boom. Quit shipping all that wheat and corn, forget the golden rule. And if they still want to play rough, we'll show them what's really tough. Let them make a loaf of bread from a gallon of crude. If you folks in the Middle East are listening to me, you better listen to what I'm saying and tell a friend. 'Cause we'll take it for a while, but once you get us riled, you're gonna think you got a tiger by the tail. If you don't lower the gas, we're gonna lower the boom. Quit shipping all that wheat and corn and forget the golden rule. Don't forget, we can last longer without crude than y'all can food. So if you don't lower the gas, we're gonna lower the boom. I'll tell you folks out there, old Bobby So Fine is having himself a rough time lately. Yesterday I coasted my 56 Cadillac down in the Ribby's Rock Song Station. I told Ribby to fill that sucker up. He took one look at me and one look at that gas hog and said, "You got to have yourself a co-signer, son." I tell you, folks, our farmers feed the world with their crops, and that includes the countries I've been talking about. If they don't lower the price of crude, we'll just raise the price of food. Let them pay $10 for a one-pound loaf of bread. If they don't lower the gas, we're gonna lower the boom. Quit shipping all that wheat and corn, forget the golden rule. We've been nice guys long enough, now's the time to get tough. Cheaper crude or no more food, and I really mean it. Cheaper crude or no more food. Are you listening, Hoss? Co-signer.
We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Meg Jacobs. She is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of multiple books. Well, I guess, yes, multiple books, I think it's fair to say, right, Meg?
Yes.
Pocketbook Politics and co-author of Conservatives in Power. Here with us to discuss your just this week, or I should say, it'll be next week or last week, released Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Meg Jacobs, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, all right, Meg, this is just sort of the synopsis here is we are looking at the politics through the lens of the two major oil shocks and just broadly speaking, the energy crisis and the lack, I guess, on some level of an energy policy. And it you describe, I mean, it covers the sort of the gamut. There's multiple reactions to the energy crisis. And in some ways, I mean, I guess it's fair to say that George Herbert Walker Bush, sort of the bookends of this, right? From the time he yep. runs for Congress to the time that he invades Kuwait. Tell us about him as a central figure through this.
The story starts even earlier with him graduating from Yale and deciding he doesn't want to take the job that he's been given in investment banking on Wall Street through his family. So he's going to pack up his Studebaker and move his family out west in search of oil in the American dream in 1948. And this is a boom time in oil. So that really bookends, as you said, the book, starting with him in search of oil out in Texas. And the book ends in 1991, sending American troops into the Persian Gulf, also in search of oil once again.
And so, I mean, is that the, I mean, why that figure? Just because he bookends it so comfortably? Or was there a sort of a quality about him which captured it?
There's a couple of reasons. One, I would say, maybe the most interesting reason is we've forgotten a whole cast of characters as we try to explain not only energy policy, but broadly American politics from the 1970s through today. When we talk about the rise of conservatism, we look often at grassroots movements, sort of the social conservatives. In fact, it was insiders in Washington, conservative insiders in Washington, who were really key to shifting the Republican Party and the country at large to the right. And George Bush is a wonderful example of this. So his father is a senator. He himself runs for Congress in the 1960s from Texas. And he's part of a whole cohort of what I call these Washington insiders who really understand how government works and try to dismantle and take it apart from the inside out. So that's one reason why he's so interesting. And I argue in the book that in this dismantling process, energy really turns out to be a key event, something that often we know sort of in a textbook way, you know, 1973 was a pivot moment with the first oil shock, but I really try to show its centrality in the shift to the right in American politics.
Yeah, I mean, you really do get a sense from the book of you know, how much is incumbent upon, you know, and I guess this is the point too, is that up to the early 70s, we had taken cheap energy as a total given at that point, right? I mean, once it starts getting squeezed, I mean, there's so much around this because, you know, I'm a huge fan of 3 Days of the Condor, which was one of the things that just sort of kept resonating for me in the background because, of course, you know, and the idea that it was that George Bush, on some level, his relationships that he was building as an oil man were the source of his power and throughout all the different positions he had in government. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he trains himself to be an oil man. You know, he's not. You see, even when he first runs for president, is on the vice president ticket in 1980, and then runs on his own in 1988. He is, in many ways, the country club Republican, but really, he's cut his teeth in Texas politics, and no one works harder than he does to bring Texas into the Republican fold, something that had not been seen as even a remote possibility when he first moves there in the 1940s. And it's through sort of oil and the connections he forges. This is when he meets James Baker, Robert Mossbacher. I mean, they're all sort of attempting to shift the South towards the GOP, and oil is really sort of formative in this way. Their argument is really simple. If you want less regulation, then the Republican Party is your answer. And they sell themselves that way.
And that's that is essentially the sort of I mean, that's when the idea of less regulation was sort of was directly tied into the idea that you're stifling business. Whereas now, I mean, maybe this is a bit of an exaggeration, but I feel like now it is almost just sort of a box that is checked off for identity politics. I mean, and that is something that I found really fascinating about your book, because, you know, obviously I remember the first oil embargo, but only as in part because it just so happens, like, I remember where we got our gas, and I remember it was Dudley Esso, and I remember distinctly being in line at Dudley Esso. We had our car parked, and there was, like, four or five cars ahead of us and, like, five or six cars behind us, and I think it just resonated with me because I played on that minor league baseball team. But there was so much going on at that time. Let's start with some of those figures that we may have forgotten. What I found really interesting, let's start with Scoop Jackson, Henry Jackson, was how much, I mean, I think it just sort of resonated. I mean, I think it was always vaguely knew where his positions were on the Cold War and that he was a New Dealer. But I don't, there was something about seeing it in the context of oil, which and energy made me think that maybe part of his sort of a sense of being a real New Deal Democrat was a function of staving off the Soviet Union.
I mean, I mean, you know, this is a case. This is a case. I mean, especially, you know, he is the figure in this where his sort of hawkish foreign policy views, in fact, reinforce his liberal domestic agenda. You know, he's so concerned about becoming dependent on insecure sources from the Middle East and how that will sort of affect standings with the Soviet Union that he pushes for a big campaign to regulate consumption in the and equalize it in the United States and sort of push for what he sees as an Apollo project, a Manhattan project for alternative energies, and he pushes them really hard. And what's interesting, and you've put your finger on it, is this sort of way in which energy is really right at the heart of the of these alternative worldviews, a sort of liberal New Deal worldview where the solution to any crisis is more regulation. So one of the things that Scoop Jackson wants to do, which is impossible to think of now, is roll back prices at the pump as they start to increase. He wants to put rationing into place so everyone can get their fair share. And on the other side are these conservatives who are actually in the Nixon administration in 1973 during the embargo, who see this as a disaster. So you end up with one of the great ironies that the first energy czar we have is William Simon, who, you know, is one of the most conservative ideologues in Washington and in the last, few decades. And here he is sort of from the center of power in charge of deciding whether the Daytona 500, you know, should be 450 instead. And it's these kind of decisions that he's forced to make, even as he's certain that any interference with the market is making the problem worse.
Yeah, I want to belabor this point because the concept, I think, that we have a well-regarded, and you know, regardless of where your politics are, this was a serious proposal that was being argued on its merits rather than some type of Red Scare, the idea of price controls, the idea of rationing.
Well, they really existed. I mean, you know, Nixon, who's ever the opportunist, you know, he's put in place all these environmental policies, but the most celebrated thing that he does, the least sort of expected thing that you would anticipate this conservative Republican to do, is to put in place across-the-board wage and price controls, which he does in 1971 because he's eager to control inflation before his reelection campaign, so this way he'll be able to stimulate the economy and avoid a recession. So he puts these in place. His advisors understand the politics, but they're horrified by this. You know, I think Schultz says it'll be easy to march in but impossible to march out, and sort of compares it to Vietnam. And they're not wrong, so that by the time 73 comes along, we're in this situation where we're increasingly dependent on imports. Imports increase like three times over in the early 1970s, and yet we are, quote unquote, stifling American producers because there's price controls in place. So they're the ones, actually, the American producers, the American Petroleum Institute, that they're the ones who first actually talk about an energy crisis even before the Arab embargo. And they say, listen, if you want to keep living the lifestyle that you're living, that you've been this wonderful post-war lifestyle with, you know, driving around in your living room on wheels, you got to free the market. And the fight actually even begins before the Arab embargo.
Now, is that a function of their understanding that we had basically, in terms of American production, and we should go back here, I mean, and remind people that as late as the late 60s, and I think the early 70s, the United States was the biggest oil producer in the country, I mean, the world.
Correct.
Right. I mean, and we had reached what was, I mean, I guess was, and this was not unpredicted or and certainly not unknowable, but basically peak oil, which was, if for the United States, which was, we've reached the limit of being able to extract oil at the cost that we were used to paying for it.
Well, the last part is incredibly important, at the cost that we were willing to pay. So the peak production comes in 1970. It's anticipated by business in the sense that they say, you know, we're going to have to go to harsher and more remote locales, and that's going to cost more money, and we're going to have to charge more money. And they are up against a liberal Congress, people like Scoop Jackson, people like Ted Kennedy, people like Tip O'Neill, who say, you know, we want the same deal we've always had, lots of oil, and we don't want to pay a lot for it. And so that's the sort of fight that's going on. And you know, part of the image of the oil industry, part of this also is about a really sort of anti-oil perception among the American public. 1969, 2 weeks into Richard Nixon's time in office, is what is at the time the biggest oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara.
Right.
And this helps to sort of jumpstart the environmental movement so that Nixon signs at the end of in the beginning of 1970, the sweeping Environmental Policy Act, you know, which would be impossible to imagine Congress today passing something equivalent. It has all this grandiose language of, you know, man and earth need to coexist, and we can. And there was very much the belief by liberals that you could. Businessmen had a different point of view, that there needed to be sort of trade-offs.
And I mean, why do you think it was possible that, I mean, and this, you know, this sort of runs throughout the entire book, I think, on some level, is this, there were a lot more, the range of potential solutions was, seems to me, much wider than anything that we discussed today. And perhaps maybe it's a function of the problem. Everybody seemed to agree on what the problem was on some level. I mean, is that accurate or no?
Well, it depends how you define it. I mean, for the majority of people, the problem was not enough and not enough at prices to be paid. There were environmentalists who said, you know, that's not the problem. The problem is that we simply use too much, right? And that sort of point of view was just beginning to emerge. But there was a perception that, well, we could regulate pollution. So there were some people, you know, who the small is beautiful argument. There was an alternative point of view, but the sort of heart of American politics, and maybe this is still true today too, Sam, is, you know, we want to continue living our consumer lifestyles, and we don't want to pay too much for it.
And that was, and just to bring this back again, is the 3 days of the Condor. I mean, that is what.
Yeah.
The Cliff Robertson says to Robert Redford. You know, see how they act when they don't have enough of their oil, basically,
right,
and justifying everything he did. And at one point, was it Ehrlichman saying this to James Akins, or I can't remember exactly where it was, but Ehrlichman, one of Nixon's, obviously one of Nixon's domestic...
About conservation?
Yes. Yeah. Tell us that quote.
Conservation is not a Republican ethic. I think that's the one that you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, and we've heard that. I feel like Cheney said something to that, like that effect, like 20 years later, 30 years later.
Yes, yes, right. You know, and that's the point of view. So, what's interesting is Nixon switches his tune. It's not that he embraces conservation, but he sees voluntary conservation as the lesser of two evils. Because as soon as you have the gas lines, there's all this tremendous push. Well, let's divide it up equally. It's impossible for us to imagine today, but rationing actually fell only 8 votes short in the Senate, and sort of had this long life, all the way lasting throughout the whole decade. So that, in fact, flashing forward, Ted Kennedy, when he runs in 1980, one of the things he promises is rationing for gasoline, because everyone thinks, okay, well, I'll just get my fair share. Nixon and Ehrlichman and all of the guys around him see this is going to be a disaster. So this is when they do things like they trot out Snoopy, they place him on, they have him depicted on the top of his doghouse, taking a nap with a bubble above it, "I believe in conservation." You know, so they have all of these appeals to voluntary conservation, and the energy companies get in on this too. So Amoco, who had Johnny Cash as a spokesman, sort of, you know, the idea of the open road, all that, they pulled those commercials, and instead you have Johnny Cash urging Americans to drive less and conserve. George C. Scott sort of said, urging people, "Don't be fuelish." That was the other big campaign. And these were sort of pushes to voluntarism as a way of sort of avoiding more heavy-handed government solutions.
So they basically said, like, this is a personal personal responsibility type of issue, right?
Right.
As opposed
right.
to something that government policy should deal with. Just tell people if the rationing had gone in, how mm-hmm. would people get it? They go to the post office and get tickets, or everybody gets mailed one?
Exactly. You would have to go get your ration book. It would be a monthly supply. The big thing, and they were under so much pressure that they actually printed up ration booklets, later only to discover that they looked too much like a $1 bill and could be used in a change machine. So they had to keep them under lock and key. If they were going to be forced to use them, Nixon's people said, and this was really sort of William Simon and Herbert Stein and George Shultz, if they were going to be forced to use them, they preferred what they called a white market in coupons. So unlike World War II, and you know, someone like Nixon, his first job in Washington was working in the Office of Price Administration, overseeing rationing for tires. If they were going to be forced to use them, they were going to allow people to trade them for money, as opposed to sort of a black market, which kind of defeats the point of them. But you know, it was a way of sort of simulating the marketplace, so that their idea was, well, if you let prices go up, because they're under price controls still at this point, you know, that would sort of inevitably clear the market and end the gas lines. I think one thing that we underestimate, this is moving the story a little bit forward, but one thing that we underestimate is sort of the intensity of the gas lines, and how much Americans sort of thought that the existence of gas lines both meant sort of the end of the world as they knew it, and a sort of breach of the social contract. You know, this was government deeply failing to take care of them.
You know, I think because I remember so little, I feel like, from my childhood, and I was probably, I must have been 7. Maybe 8, I think, when I was sitting in Dudley Esso gas line. And I remember, like, it being a big deal. I mean, I don't, I mean, just remember being in the gas line, and I remember there being anger. It's tough to divorce that necessarily for what was going on at home at times, but I remember. I remember there being like just frustration that I couldn't quite.
So do you remember the 73? 73, 74? Do you remember the?
No, I remember 73, 74. By 79, I was, I was riding a bike. That was not an issue for me. But I remember because I was my minor league baseball team when I was like seven or whatever it was Dudley Esso. And so that's
there
why
you were as a little kid sitting without a seatbelt in the front seat. So things have changed.
Yes. I think we used to go in the way back because that was more fun. We had one of those like Plymouth Furies and Dudley would come out and it was. You know, it was actually sort of fun, but it was weird. I do remember it being very strange. And what is clear from your book is that it had an impact on a multitude of things that were going on. Like, I never realized it was so close to Watergate in terms of all this stuff is happening. There must have been a total siege mentality at the White House that was, I mean, which it's arguable as to which was bigger at the time for a lot.
Well, you know, I mean, this was perhaps self-serving, but Nixon and his advisors around him believed that the energy crisis was bigger. And maybe that was self-serving because they believed they could do something about it.
Right.
But the polls showed this too. So, you know, one of the top pollsters, reported repeatedly to the White House that people cared more about the gas lines than about Watergate, you know, and even to Scoop Jackson, and this animated him too, you know, people writing in letters saying, you know, please rename the Watergate investigation committees to, you know, the energy crisis committees, and let's get to the bottom of this problem. There was a tremendous amount of anger because for a couple of reasons. One is that even though these were precipitated by foreign events, Americans believed that they were the result of big oil conspiracy. You know, this was sort of, they were certain that energy companies were holding gasoline off the market to try to get rid of price controls and raise the prices again. They were certain about this, and they were certain that the president was letting them get away with it. And so there was tremendous anger. And somebody like Scoop Jackson, who had his own presidential ambitions, played to this. So in January 1974, when Congress, after, you know, Congress has recessed and everyone goes home for the recess and sees how angry people are because you have all the Christmas trees without lights and everyone, you know, all Christmas is ruined in 1973 because you can't use electricity. And they come back and Scoop Jackson holds these televised hearings where he calls the executives from all the big oil companies to Washington. He has them sit impaneled behind a table in the same room, actually, as the Watergate hearings, and he accuses them of what he calls obscene profits. He takes them apart. And this was a popular thing for him to do, even if it didn't really produce any more gas or alleviate the line.
And there was such pressure that Nixon, during his State of the Union address in January of 74, basically lied, right, about the, and we should tell people what we have to sort of, I mean, I think most people know, but maybe younger folks don't, of what, why there was this oil shock. I mean, we were headed towards a squeeze, it seems to me, but then we got to a sort of like a cliff, right? And that, and the cliff was what?
Well, I mean, you had this sort of perfect storm developing because, as you say, there's a squeeze, sort of rising demand, lessening supply, increasing reliance on imports, and the leaders of the OPEC countries understood this. So you have someone like Gaddafi in Libya and even Saudi Arabia, our ally, warning the United States that they might need to unsheath the oil weapon if they're not more cooperative in their support of Israel. And in fact, what happens is in October, and this is where the timing does track very well with Watergate, in October, when Egypt and Syria invade Israel in the Yom Kippur War, and the United States supports Israel, this is what then triggers the Arab members of OPEC to institute an embargo. And even more than the embargo led by Saudi Arabia, which was the biggest producer then, as is now in the region, decides to massively cut back its production. So it changes the whole global oil market and leads to a reduction in supply. So that's what precipitating event was.
And we should also say that at that point, the U.S. in support of Israel was very much a part and parcel of the Cold War. I mean, this was, I mean, in a way that obviously I think, people under the age of 30 don't necessarily understand today.
Yeah, so Nixon's sort of caught because Kissinger is his guy there. This is when he starts his famous shuttle diplomacy, and he arranges Kissinger a ceasefire, but he can't get an end to the embargo. And Nixon's kind of caught because Kissinger's telling him, stop talking about the embargo because that's just going to make us look weak and they're going to use it even more, and we need to sort of figure out how we're going to make sure that we're in control of these negotiations more than the Soviets. But Nixon is desperate to get more gas to the gas stations. And so it's this sort of desire and impulse to address an immediate, what he saw as sort of gut level problem that pushes him to announce in a State of the Union, I have it on good word, we're pretty close to doing something about the embargo, which was completely not true. Kissinger was furious at him. And in fact, scholars say that this actually extended the embargo because then the Saudis needed to sort of prove that they were tough and not going to give in to the Americans.
And Nixon also has this, I guess, this intense pressure, too, at this point, because he needs something else to talk about besides Watergate.
Right. You know, it's at the end of the speech when he says, by the way, I'm not going to resign. I'm going to do the job that I was elected to do. So, these two are sort of intimately connected. He wants to change the conversation from Watergate, but this isn't a good conversation for him either, as it turns out. And certainly not, by the end of January, beginning of February. February, you have 11-day nationwide trucker strike, which is inconceivable to us today. And the president's just silent throughout all of this. You have literally people, truckers, who are on strike on the side of the road, sniping at truckers who are still running their big rigs. It's chaotic.
And by sniping, you mean shooting at.
I do mean shooting at.
Yeah. I mean, this is the other thing that I realized from reading your book. The reason why trucker culture was so huge at that time was because they were such a huge player in our politics. Over the next, 5 or 6 years or something, this is when the whole CB culture was sort of exploding.
Yeah.
And you write about it as CBs becoming this sort of town square sort of common. This is the Twitter of the day. But I remember as a kid was the songs and Smokey and the Bandit. And
right.
There was so many songs. I remember just having cassette recordings of taping the radio where it was Breaker, Good Buddy, and having a CB term book and stuff like that. And so does that last throughout the era? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, filling up at a gas station now becomes, it becomes like this political act, because or not filling up as the case might be. And these truckers, they had been so lionized as sort of these icons of American individualism, these sort of, highway cowboys, but then they become these highway guerrillas. They were sort of thought to be kind of conservative, they didn't, the guys who led the strike were not Teamsters. They didn't belong to a union. They sort of rejected that. They supported the war in Vietnam, and here they are, these kind of social conservatives becoming these highway guerrillas, and everyone was on their side because they were doing things like calling for a rollback at the pump, you know. And so a young Senator Joseph Biden sees his chance, and he rides a big rig 536 miles from Delaware to Ohio, and then, you know, reports back, "I understand, you know, I feel their pain. I understand why they're protesting." And it's kind of amazing. It's not just sort of a strike at one factory, but this is across the whole country. And so you're right, these CBs were sort of like the Twitter of the day, and they sort of build this kind of newly discovered consciousness among the truckers that, you know, that they sort of take up the tools of mass action. And it does continue throughout the 70s. So in 79, we have the same thing happen. And in fact, in some ways, it's much worse because it's happening again. So in 79, when you have a reduction in supply because of the Iranian Revolution, their gas lines form again. And it is worse because it's Jimmy Carter, and Jimmy Carter has promised Americans that he's going to solve the energy crisis. It's under Jimmy Carter that we create the Department of Energy, and it's a disaster when these lines form. And you have the same thing, the anger on the lines, and another trucker strike, you know. And so in the midst of this is when Carter does two things that we remember him for, but we might not remember that they occur as there's gas lines and trucker strikes going on across the country. One is the installing of the solar panels on the White House roof. So that sort of seemed good, but didn't really do anything to alleviate the immediate pain. And the other thing we remember him for, of course, is his famous melee speech, the crisis of confidence speech. And, you know, academics get all excited about this speech, like finally a president's telling Americans, you know, they consume too much and it's their fault and they should be more moral, virtuous people. But this is not what the public wanted to hear at the time.
And this is when they set their thermometers to 65 degrees. And what's interesting, too, about this period is it seems that this is where we enter into sort of a more modern version and of sort of almost conservative identity politics. It seems to me, obviously this stuff is there in a myriad of different ways, but that somehow this issue becomes, because it seems like the history of this is that the energy crisis, the oil crunch, whatever, oil, just cheap energy, becomes a pivot point for a whole host of ideologies and players, right? I mean, this is like everybody sort of like wraps their rope around this pole and swings in whichever way they want, or it pulls them into the center of power. You know, I'm talking about, like, you know, Rumsfeld gets mentioned in this as Ford comes up, and Dick Cheney, of course, and like you say, you know, we see this on the left as well. But and we were talking about this, it was amazing, and we entered into we'll have hopefully played this song as an example of what was going on. But the minority freeze, or I should say the focal minority, it's called, it freeze a Yankee. And this becomes, you know, like sort of something that we recognize. I mean, to me, it sounds like, you know, on some level, like Donald Trump now, where you get into this notion of it becomes, you know, this battle becomes sort of a way, like a cultural identifier.
You've mapped that trajectory, right? I mean, what you have really from the beginning of my story, which, as we said, starts with George Bush to really sort of the end of the story, is the sort of alliance of conservative Republicans also with sort of the South that sort of culminates in Ronald Reagan's election. And sort of this is great moment from the 1980 Republican convention in which Reagan, we forget that one of the things that he is able to sort of build his campaign on is the huge failure of Carter on the energy thing. So for Reagan, this is really Exhibit A of what the government messes up and what the government can't do. And so when he delivers his famous line, government is not the solution, government is the problem, he means the energy crisis and the example of that. And so on the floor of the convention, which takes place in Detroit in the summer of 1980, delegates wear buttons that say, that read, "A Democrat shot JR," which of course is, you know, their answer to that sensationalized summer cliffhanger, you know, series-ending cliffhanger on Dallas. You know, J.R. Ewing gets shot. Nobody knows who shot him.
This is a big oil man, we should say. He's a big oil man.
So he is sort of like the iconic, you know, American independent oil man. And by, you know, 1980, it's clear that Republicans, conservative Southerners, Texans, they think the problem is the Democrats. And as you say, this kind of sectionalism, this kind of polarization on this issue really is felt most strongly in the South and Southwest, where you have all these energy producers. So it's in the Carter period in the summer of 1978 that this this folk band, the Focal Minority, releases a song, "Freeze a Yankee," you know, and the idea is that if those horrible liberals did not control prices, then there would be enough energy. They're talking about natural gas because natural gas was controlled too, but they're talking about all energy. Then there would be enough for everyone. So, you know, so they have great lyrics where they say, you know, Kennedy said he's not going to let us drill off the continental shelf. You know, well, you know, we could tell them all to go to Hyannisport, you know, and this idea that it's the liberal Democrats that are limiting our supply. And so the solution is to just drive your cars as fast as you can, use as much energy as you can, and that will freeze a Yankee, and then they'll come around and change their policy.
And just and be a little bit more to be a little more explicit about this, you point out, I mean, we have Tip O'Neill, right, in charge of Congress, charge, but he's the Speaker of the House, Ted Kennedy, who is so prominent that he's challenging Jimmy Carter in a year or so, or has already started to.
Right.
Both these guys are from Massachusetts, and it's the Northeast that is traditionally has the most problem with severe winters, broadly speaking, in terms of getting heating oil. I don't know, why is it always New England as opposed to, let's say, I don't know, Minnesota or something?
Well, it's there too. But, you know, drive 75 and freeze them alive. You know, that's sort of the idea. I mean, partly the answer isn't so interesting because the Northeast is more reliant on heating oil than any, at least in this period of time, than any other part of the country. So they sort of target it. But, you know, it's people like Les Aspin, you know, other sort of Midwestern liberals who are in favor of the same policies, you know, so that they're part of the coalition.
And this becomes, you know, this, I mean, this, if we haven't already played the song, we're going to play it on the outro here. And maybe it makes more sense to play it at the end so that people understand the sort of the intensity and the sort of the nature. So the issue has become sort of, I mean, it has become weaponized in a way. I mean, it starts as a weapon for the producers, but it becomes another sort of arrow in the quiver of conservatives to make this argument. And they're not making this argument during Nixon or Ford, right? That a government just can't figure this out. They're only making it over the course of Carter because it becomes more... I mean, is that it? I mean,
they start earlier. So, you know, you have Milton Friedman, you know, for him, too, the energy crisis is also Exhibit A on the disastrous, you know, policies of liberal government. And, you know, so he writes, you know, publishes all these, you know, he has a weekly Newsweek column in which he says, you know, the solution to getting rid of the lines is just get rid of controls and we won't have a problem. And so actually the Nixon and Ford administration are interesting because you do have people like William Simon who are saying, you know, if you just fire me and put me out of work and get rid of all of these regulations, everything will be fine. But they're facing this huge liberal Congress. One thing that we forget often when we talk about the 70s is that liberals actually are pretty strong still. We sort of imagine this world of after the 60s they've gone, and by the 80s. But in the 70s, they're really still strong, and that's part of the problem. So they just really can't do anything. And then when they're out of the White House in the Carter period, then they really can hammer home. And another element that comes much more to the fore and isn't really on the table in the first oil shock is the role of foreign policy, which we haven't talked too much about.
Right.
So the other song, you know, if the book has sort of a soundtrack to it, would be Cheaper Crude or No More Food. And that's a popular song in 79. And the idea by this period is that we're getting screwed by Arab sheikhs, you know, who and also Iran, you know, who have this ability to blackmail us and hold us hostage by their control of oil. So that argument, the idea that we need to, that's where I thought you were going when you said militarize, weaponize. So that argument that the solution isn't just increasing and freeing our domestic market, but going and militarizing the Gulf and protecting those resources reaches culmination in the late 70s and then in the Reagan-Bush era.
So what does that mean? Cheaper crude or no more food? Like, you're not going to get support from us anymore, or we're going to cut it off, or what?
Cut it off. So, you know, if we export wheat to you and you won't continue to supply us with the oil that we want, you're not going to get our wheat anymore. That's the argument. You know, and it receives backing from people like Moynihan, you know, and it has this sort of popular currency, even if it's not really based in a reality in the sense of, you know, our dependence on fuel is greater and their ability to get wheat from elsewhere is greater. But still, it sort of has a kind of cultural cachet to it.
What? So, I mean, and I know that we're leaving a little bit of this or a lot of foreign policy on the table here, being now 30, 40 years out, 30, almost mm-hmm. 35 years out from the mm-hmm. first sort of like real clarion call, right? That there's a problem here, and the idea that and that's first where we get this notion of like, hey, maybe growth isn't sort of like the answer to it all, or this is
right.
these chickens are going to come home to roost. I mean, is this an example of sort of the increasing failure of our system of government being able to address a major problem? I mean, we don't seem to have an energy policy today. I mean, is there been a time we had maybe 6 months during the Carter administration, maybe longer, but that we actually had sort of a genuine energy policy? Or is it just like, just find it where you can find it?
That doesn't sound so catchy, but might have the virtue of being accurate. you know, so when the Arab embargo happens in 73 and Nixon realizes, okay, I have to make some big statement here, which takes him a few weeks to do, what he declares is Project Independence, right? And, you know, that's kind of probably wasn't a great idea because then it sort of articulated, in fact, what the problem as Americans perceived it to be, which was dependence. And unlike today when we talk about energy dependence, you know, like on fossil fuels or whatever, what he meant and what this meant across the spectrum was sort of dependence on foreign oil. So the idea, and this was embraced by Nixon, by Ford, by Carter, is that we would reach self-sufficiency.
By Palin. I mean, drill, baby, drill, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
that was sort of the goal, right?
It's still around.
These were the early sort of proponents of drill, baby, drill. That's right. And, you know, and nuclear, we were going to build 200 more nuclear plants. And, you know, Carter's was sort of more environmentally friendly. So, you know, he had this idea that we would get 20% of our energy needs from the sun. You know, he was certain that he could make that happen. But the idea would be that we would achieve independence from abroad. That really changes with the end of the Cold War. The problem in 73 is we don't have any military response to what was an aggressive act against American interests, because as you mentioned earlier, this is in the middle of the Cold War, and more than that, this is the country's war weary because of Vietnam. So behind closed doors, you know, there's discussion, can we do anything? And the answer is no, we can't do anything. But when Saddam Hussein moves into Kuwait in 1990, the idea then is, Bush says, you know, energy security is national security, and the focus shifts really from independence to security and sort of an acceptance that it's okay to import.
Because we now have the leverage to make sure that they keep import, they keep selling to us.
Correct.
And
that's right.
And then the sad thing is that, you know, we still have this sort of myth. I mean, obviously, it's a world market, but the percentage of oil that we get from the Middle East now is, you know, if it's double digits, it's like only around 15%. The rest we get from maybe Venezuela and Canada, I guess. It is a world market. But now it's really also, we have, I mean, it seems to me that the 93 invasion of Kuwait was about us having learned the lesson that, like, hey, this is a really potent weapon. Just having control of oil is a potent weapon. We should get ourselves in this game of being able to, at the very least, project some ability to cut off maybe China's oil or something to that effect.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this started, you mentioned Rumsfeld and Cheney. They do appear in my story. They are sort of, along with Bush, sort of perfect examples of these Washington insiders, people who shift government to the right from within. It's an interesting parallel today because, you know, of course, Ted Cruz is sort of the ultimate insurgent, but he's right. A senator. So we could talk about that too. So these guys, you know, are shifting, pushing Washington to the right from inside, and they start in the Nixon administration, and they really become quite powerful in the Ford administration as chief of staff and secretary of defense. And, you know, they are in favor of a more enhanced military in the Middle East. They just really, their hands are tied. And it's only after the Soviets invade Afghanistan, not even after the hostage crisis, but only after the Soviets invade Afghanistan, that Carter makes his big Carter Doctrine speech in his State of the Union address in 1980 that says, you know, any attempt to shut down the Persian Gulf and limit access to oil will be seen as an attack on our national interest, and we'll use any force necessary to defend. And that's a pivot. It's not one that's realized really until Operation Desert Storm in 1991.
So, lastly, is the story here that oil is, or energy is, a fundamental, is such a fundamental undergirding of our politics? I mean, at some level, you know, this was a time where it was sort of very obvious. Now it's weird because we're paying, and I don't know in inflation dollars if we're really paying that much, or we were at $4 a gallon. I mean, you know, the idea that you can get gas now under $2 a gallon just seems weird to me. In the final analysis, is it that cheap energy and energy is so relevant to our politics in a way that we're not even conscious of it? Or is it, and maybe these are not mutually exclusive, that because this energy was a power source, literally for like a political power source for the right, just by happenstance, right? I mean, I guess in an alternate reality, we had solar farms and all these, green activists, took power. Is it this is what has empowered the right, is because they happen to own the, sort of this incredibly important aspect of our society, which we don't really sort of see on a daily basis? Or
I have to say, and I don't think you'll disagree with this, Sam, the commitment to cheap energy is really a bipartisan issue,
right?
Because ultimately, it's something Americans care about deeply. And so as much progress as we have made in controlling emissions in Paris and Obama using executive authority, it still doesn't address the underlying reality that American consumption continues to increase, and Americans continue to expect cheap prices. So, the two headline bits of news today is that OPEC can't stabilize the market, so there's going to be low prices. So that's good for consumers and bad for the environment. And Obama's about to go to Saudi Arabia. So, even as oil prices are low, we still see the cost in terms of sort of ongoing military commitment and alliance with these powerful players. I would say that because we have this sort of fundamental conviction that Americans have a right to cheap and abundant energy, that ended up playing into the hands of Republicans, because it was when government could not deliver on that promise that it helped to undermine and delegitimize government as a whole. So, if Vietnam and Watergate taught us that we could not trust our politicians, it was the energy crisis of the 70s that taught us that government didn't work. And that's what ended up was sort of the final nail in the coffin and ended up giving momentum to this sort of anti-government argument that the right has used so successfully.
And the fascinating thing is, obviously, Democrats can't make the argument for reasons that it goes against their sort of their political ethos anyways. They can't explicitly mm-hmm. say government works now that gas is under $2 a gallon. However,
right.
The Democratic nominee, whoever that ends up being, is probably going to benefit significantly from gasoline prices.
There's a poll there's a poll that shows that the Moody poll came out, said, okay, we can have all the debates and all of the primaries and whatever, but with gas prices, at these sort of historic lows, that those will benefit the Democrats. So we'll see. We'll see.
Cue the right-wing conspiracy theories about Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia as he, by all accounts, probably he's just offering fealty to Islam to get in return cheaper gasoline until his Islamic brethren can take over the United States. I know you don't endorse that part of the argument, Meg. I'm not going to make it.
I didn't go there.
Indeed. Panic at the pump. We have a link at majority.fm, the energy crisis and the transformation of American politics in the 1970s. Meg Jacobs, thanks so much for your time today. It's a fascinating read. And I know Matt here in the office is going to grab it out of my arms as soon as we are done talking.
Thanks so much, Sam. It was fun talking to you.
And we're going to play that focal minority. I love that pun. Freeze a Yankee now.
Freeze a Yankee, drive 75 and freeze him alive. Freeze a Yankee, let your thermostat rise and give him a surprise. Governor Briscoe promised us that if any damn Yankee raised a fuss, he'd turn off the gas, cut off the oil, and let them all freeze and boil. They don't want an oil rig around their seashore, Lord, it's a terrible sight. And don't you try to drill in their dirty old water. If you do, you're in for a fight.
Senator Kennedy told me himself that he wouldn't let us drill on the continental shelf. So when they try to get Texans to drill another well, we can tell them all to go to Hyannisport.
Now President Carter was a good old boy, a southerner through and through. But when he asked all Americans to sacrifice, he really meant you know who. He wants all our oil and our nuclear fuels. What does he take us for, silly fools? The president wants us to pass our gas. Now ain't that a kick in the
breeze? A Yankee drive 75 and freeze him alive. Freeze a Yankee, let your thermostat rise and give him a surprise. Governor Briscoe promised us that if any damn Yankee raised a fuss, he'd turn off the gas, cut off the oil, and let them all freeze and boil. Cram them Yankees in little bitty cars while we ride around in limousines. There ain't nothing in the world any more fun than pumping gas in them big machines. Us Texans love our Cadillacs, big Continentals and Pontiacs. We're gonna keep all the gas we can make and let them Yankees shiver and shake.
Well, them Yankees say they need our oil and they gotta have gasoline. But don't you put no refineries away up north. They want to keep their air real clean. They only got enough lignite to last till midnight. Not enough fuel to keep their beer real cool. But we'll send you lots of oil now, don't you fear, if you promise not to move down here.
Freeze a Yankee, drive 75 and freeze them alive. Freeze a Yankee, let your thermostat rise and give him a surprise. Governor Briscoe promised us that if any damn Yankee raised a fuss, he'd turn off the gas, cut off the oil, and let them all freeze and boil. Freeze a Yankee. Hallelujah. Save your Confederate credit cards. The South won't arise again.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid.